Morning. So much of who we are today is reflected on what has happened in our past. And a common technique in movies or television series is the flashback. And in the flashback, you're dialing in on a character's story as you're getting to know that character, and as that character's life is developing and story is being told, it often the flashback will go back to a period in time that was a defining moment for that character. And in this morning's stories that we're going to look at in Luke chapter 8, I want to take us back to a flashback and look at the story of 12 years before the stories that we're going to look at this morning. And the first story flashes back to 12 years of joy, to this young Jewish couple who were gaining stature in their community and gaining stature in the synagogue. It was almost as if this young man and his wife, he was on a trajectory to be a leader one day. And they, 12 years before the stories we look at this morning, this young Jewish man and his wife had a little baby girl. And it was their only little baby girl. But it brought them so much joy. And as so many of you have, you had these years of rearing this little daughter, and it was filled with joy. And they didn't have photo albums back then, but it had been photo albums filled with great memories and great times. And it was full of joy. And then I want to take you back to 12 years of misery in a different story. This is, take you back to a story of a woman who had a blood disease where constantly she would have this flow of blood. We're not told much about it. And she would go to doctor after doctor, trying to find help, trying to find someone who could provide her some sort of cure. And if you've ever had some sort of disease or ailment or something wrong with your body, you know that pain where you've gone to a doctor and they're truly practicing medicine. You go to them and you try to find out what's wrong and you don't get many answers. And we all know how frustrating that can be. And that's with all of our technological advances that we have today. But take you back over 2,000 years ago, and this woman going through over a decade of searching, trying to find the answers to her health and coming up with nothing. And in her time, as we'll see, this had not only implications for her health, but it also had her implications for how she was viewed in society and even within her religious society. And so we pick up this story in Luke chapter 8. And Jesus is going along with his disciples, much like the story last week. And just like the story last week, we have the meeting of two crowds, two different reactions to Jesus and his ministry and the disciples who were following him. We finish up with the story in Acts 8 that we won't go into much, but Jesus has just cast out a demon from a demon-possessed man, and he had cast out the demons into a herd of pigs, and the pigs do this kind of weird thing, and they run into the ocean and or into the sea, and they all die. And that makes some of the townsmen angry, and some of those people who lived in this town where Jesus had been passing through. And so people witness this miracle of Jesus, that he's cast out these demons, and it says that all the people of the region of Gerasenes asked Jesus to leave them because they were overcome with fear. And so he got into the boat and left. And so you have one reaction to Jesus, a crowd that sees what Jesus has to offer and sees what he does, and they respond in fear. And ultimately, they reject him. And then he continues to move on and go on. But in contrast to that, it says, now when Jesus returned, a crowd welcomed him, for they were expecting him. And we all have different reactions to Jesus, just like these crowds. And that's a constant theme throughout the ministry of Jesus, is some who would accept him, some who would reject him. But among that crowd who welcomed him was a man. And it's kind of funny, as we look at how to pronounce this man's name, you know, I'm always conscious, I want to pronounce things right. When you when you preach. And this will give you a little insider knowledge to how that works and thinking about how to pronounce things. And so I have a very unsophisticated way to figure out how to pronounce a name like that. Is I went to Bible Gateway, and you could see all the translations in audio Bibles because I was having trouble. How do you say this? Is it Jairus? Is it Jairus? How do you say it? And every translation that I listened to try to figure out how to say it, said it differently. Whether it was Jairus or Jairus, and they all said it in such an academic, Jairus or Jairus, and like they knew, you know, that was the way to pronounce it. But the fact is, you know, everyone pronounces it differently. And so I'm going to go with Chad. Chad determined it today. We're going to say Jairus. So it says, then a man named Jairus, a synagogue leader, came and fell at Jesus' feet, pleading with him to come to his house. So Jairus was that young man, 12 years before, who had had a little daughter and had these 12 years of joy of raising their daughter, had just memory after memory of his daughter, and everything was good. Everything was great. But he comes and says he falls at Jesus' feet, which is odd because he's a synagogue leader. And if you read through the Gospels, you realize it's a theme that it's sort of up in the air whether or not Jesus is going to be received well by the leaders, the Jewish leaders, or whether he's going to be rejected. But this one does something different. Rather than rejecting Jesus and sending him out, he falls at his feet, which is sort of a shocking reaction to what we would expect from the religious elite at that time. It says he fell at his feet and pleaded because his only daughter of about 12 was dying. And so, yes, there were all kinds of different reactions to Jesus. But in this instance, we see this respected Jewish leader falling at Jesus' feet, pleading with him to do something about his daughter. And it's interesting because so many of the religious leaders rejected Jesus. It's interesting that this man comes to him for help. Most of the time they were sending Jesus packing, telling him to get out of town. In this instance, he was asking for help. And I don't know, but maybe it's just the fact that when we are brought to our knees by the facts of life and the circumstances of life like this, where 12 years of joy comes to an end, or it seems like it's coming to an end as his young daughter is dying. And so for him, reality becomes crystal clear in that moment. You ever experienced that before? Where it seems like when you're faced with the realities of life, the hardships of life, all of the sort of issues that are going on in our world seem so small. Because right now, you are facing a crisis, you're facing a challenge. And it brings us to our knees. And for people of faith, it brings us to the feet of Jesus as well. And that's what it did for this religious leader. Who is this man, all the political implications of who this man was, and all the debate and all the hearsay, all that was put out of his mind. He was sort of crystal clear on a path. If this man can help, I need to go to him. And that's what Jairus does. He comes to Jesus, falls at his feet, and he asks for help. And Jesus apparently said yes. It says, and as Jesus was on his way, the crowds almost crushed him. Apparently, there was some needed travel that needed to take place for Jesus to go to his house. But as he was doing it, as we said, the crowd had welcomed him. And this crowd was so excited to see who he was. They probably heard rumors about who he was, or they had witnessed one of his miracles. They were coming around him and crushing him. And you have to imagine this was frustrating for Jairus. You know, his daughter is dying, and he doesn't know how much time she had left, and now it's one of those moments where you're trying to get going, but you're stuck in a traffic jam. You ever have that? Seems like traffic is moving, just flowing until you're in a hurry or until you're a little bit late. And then all of a sudden, you get stuck at every stoplight. You get on the interstate and everything's backed up. You know, someone cuts you off. You come up to one of those four-way stops and there's like lines on all four corners, and you're going to have those kind of awkward waves where everyone, you're going to go and then you stop going and then you kind of give that little wave and then finally someone goes. It's one of those moments where you're trying to get going, you're in a hurry, and it seems like everything's just slowing it down. Now, the text doesn't go into that much, but I imagine Jairus had some of that anxiety of knowing that his daughter only had so much time, and he had heard that Jesus can heal the sick. And so he knew time was pressing. He needed Jesus to get there. And he had faith that Jesus would be able to do so if he could get there before she died. And it's in this rush, it's in this big crowd where people are just pressing up against him that we're introduced to the second story, that flashback that I took you to, the 12 years of misery that this woman had gone through. And we're introduced to this woman. It said, now, and a woman was there and had been subject to bleeding for 12 years, and no one could heal her. We talked about her, that struggle, 12 years of searching, 12 years of just trying to find an answer to some of the health issues she was having. And no one had any answer. No one was able to help her. And as we've mentioned already, that carried not only implications for her health, how frustrating that would be to not be able to stop bleeding, but it also had implications for her socially and religiously as a Jewish woman. If you look in Leviticus chapter 15, and specifically, I'm not going to pop this up on the screen, but it is specifically in verses 19 through 23, it gives some guidelines for ceremonial cleanliness. And what that meant was whether or not someone could enter into the realm of worship, whether they were clean or unclean. It didn't have necessarily any implication for them morally, but it's just all sorts of situations when you go throughout Leviticus 14 through 19. It talks about who can approach the throne and how they need to do that. And there was ways. If you were unclean, it wasn't all that big of a deal. There were ways to become clean, and there was processes to follow. And in this case, for a woman with a flow of blood, the process was to, you'd be unclean for 7 days, but then you would, you know, go through the process that is outlined in those chapters, and you'd become clean. It was no big deal. But in her situation, she never stopped bleeding. So she was in this constant state of uncleanliness. And one of the things about being unclean is that you couldn't, if someone were to touch you, they were then to become unclean. And so in that case, no one would want to touch her. They would not want to become ceremonially unclean. And there's a lot there, a lot that we could talk about that we don't have time to go into this morning, to talk about that sacrificial system and cleanliness and all that, and what it means to be clean or unclean. But to suffice it to say, the fact that she was constantly in the state of being unclean would have meant not only that she had probably not had many opportunities to experience a hug or human touch for 12 years, but also the fact that she would be excluded from the worship and not be able to come into the gathering of people. Not to say that she couldn't seek God, but she was excluded from the community. And isn't that a big deal? Didn't we feel that during COVID and the pandemic when the church was unable to gather together? Didn't you miss being able to just go up and hug your brother and sister, to shake their hand, to be able to see their whole face, not just their eyes, you know? It just we crave that interaction with our brothers and sisters in Christ. We missed that during the pandemic. Yeah, we're grateful we had the technology to be able to watch on the screen. We still have that capability for many who can't be with us or are traveling. But at the same time, there's just something about being together, being gathered together with our brothers and sisters in Christ, hearing the voices in person and not through the speakers on an iPhone. Something we longed for. And so we can understand where this woman was coming from. Excluded from that gathering, likely, for 12 years because of this issue she had. It wasn't just a health issue. It had all sorts of implications for a first century Jewish woman. And she was affected by that. No one could heal her. She couldn't find the answers. And so she hears of this man named Jesus, and she sees this crowd gathered by him saying, he's a miracle worker. He's healed people. He's cast out demons. He's healed the blind. He's healed deaf people. And she thinks, just has this sort of kernel of a thought, well, maybe he could heal me. But if you remember, she couldn't touch anybody. And so she has a dilemma. She's thinking, I can't just go up and touch this respected Jewish teacher, this up-and-coming famous person. I can't go up and touch him. The crowd would team up, and they would go against me. They would send me out. Like, this isn't going to go well for her to just go up and to touch this new respected leader. So she has this problem. But I think she has this thought. We're not quite told this, that she, you know, we're not given the process. We're just sort of told this story, as we are many stories in the Bible, told them as sort of matter of fact. We're given the facts of what happened. But I imagine she thought, well, okay, I can't touch him. I can't let people see that I touched him and cause him to be unclean. But if I could just touch maybe just the hem of his garment, maybe I would find the relief I need. Maybe I would find the healing I would need. And so she squeezes her way through that crowd, trying to be unseen, trying to make sure not to call attention to herself so that she could just get close enough to the teacher. Even if I can just reach out and grab the hem of the garment that's hanging down, maybe I'll experience healing. And that's what she does. So she came up behind him, touched the edge of his cloak, or some translations say hem of the garment, and it worked. Immediately, her bleeding stopped. And as you would imagine, she's wanting to sort of scoot now, get out of there. And it wasn't because she was trying to take anything from the teacher, but it was because of the embarrassment. She was a social outcast at this point, and she thought she might be in trouble, or there might be some other implications for what she has done. And then to her surprise, she thought, this was a way. I'll touch it. No one will ever know. I'll find the answers I'm looking for. But to her surprise, Jesus turns around and stops and asks, who touched me? And what's interesting, that same word for touch is that same, it comes from the same word, at least used in the Greek Old Testament, Septuagint, comes from that same word that we find in Leviticus chapter 15. It's, of course, in Hebrew, but the Greek version, same word for touch, is my understanding, at least. And so within the, Jesus asks this question, his disciples are confused. They're like, Jesus, you're walking through this, Master, you're walking through this crowd of people. They're all pressing up against you. What do you mean, who touched you? And Jesus knew, of course, exactly what he meant. That's what Peter speaks for the disciples, as he so often does. He says, Master, the people are crowding around you, pressing against you. What do you mean, who touched you? But Jesus says, someone touched me, and I know because power has gone out from me. And I find that so interesting. Because it's not as if you could just take Jesus' power from him, as if it was like, if I were to just touch him, you would be healed. But it was something Jesus had, we know from this side, Jesus had exercised this power, had freely given this power. But why does he have this conversation? Why doesn't he just allow the woman to go and to go on and to live her life? But instead, the woman, says the woman, realizes it was all lost. And seeing that she could not go unnoticed, came trembling and fell at his feet. She's like, here it goes. I'm in trouble. I've touched the master. I'm going to cause him to be unclean. I touched the teacher. It says, and in the presence of all the people, she told why she had touched him and how she had been instantly healed. Just explain, it's like, I've been looking for answers. I've been searching for 12 years. I heard rumors about this teacher. I just thought it would do no harm just to touch the hem of the garment. And what Jesus then says, he says, daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace. It wasn't some magical power that the garment had of Jesus that if she were to touch it, she would be healed. But it was her exercise of faith in Jesus' knowledge of all things, where he knew she was there. It wasn't a secret. And it was through her faith that he healed her. It wasn't touching a garment, but it was the fact that she saw that God's power was so powerful that if she would just touch the hem of the garment, she'd be healed. But I think what's most significant about this is, why did Jesus do this? Why did he address her? Why didn't he just let her go? And as some scholars would suggest, it was likely Jesus was taking this opportunity to lift this marginalized woman up, restore her back into a right place in society where she could be seen. But did you notice she's so used to being unseen? She said, it says, then the woman, seeing that she could not go unnoticed, that's when she comes forward and falls at the feet of Jesus. She was so used to being overlooked, so used to being ostracized from those around her, so used to being marginalized, not included, that in this instance, this was one of the first times she had been noticed and she'd been seen by Jesus. She comes to him with fear and trembling. And we realize it can be a fearful thing to be seen by God. However, Jesus shows that it's actually a good thing to be seen by God. He calls her daughter. Daughter. So much of society would have looked at this woman as unclean, unincluded, marginalized, but Jesus calls her daughter, which I think is significant as this story is sandwiched between this other story with this synagogue leader who is worried about his daughter. And I think it's the fact that Jesus sees her and elevates her back to her to a right place in society, and that he sees her just as much as a beloved daughter as that synagogue leader loved his own daughter. And so the story continues, and as we've said already, Jairus in this instance would have been had high anxiety. This whole story, although for us is this meaningful, powerful story, but for Jairus, he's thinking, okay, the clock's ticking. We've got to get going. I'm sure he's frustrated at this point. Like, I've asked you to do something. Will you please come with me? Let's go. Let's move on. Why are we talking to this woman? And it says, and while Jesus was still speaking, someone came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue leader, and said, your daughter is dead. He says, don't bother the teacher anymore. And while it seemed like the 12 years for that woman with the blood issue, like that had just been set right, that had just been reversed. At this point in the story, it also feels like that 12 years of joy had been reversed. As Jairus has just received news that period of his life was coming to an end, his daughter had died. And we just imagine the hopelessness that he felt. And again, there's this mixture, as we saw last week, this mixture of joy and despair all in the same story, which is so true to our life. As one person is rejoicing, one person is suffering a loss and weeping a loss. And that's just true of life. But Jesus reassures Jairus. He says, hearing this, Jesus said to Jairus, don't be afraid, just believe, and she will be healed. Just believe. He says, in the words of Journey, he says, don't stop believing. Have faith. Your faith has come this far. Keep it going. You've come to me beyond all shadow of doubt, the synagogue leader, you know, with all the other voices of who this new teacher was and who Jesus was, people who were condemning Jesus and trying to outcast him, trying to stop his ministry from growing. He had all these voices in his ear. And he came to Jesus, and now she has died. He's lost hope. Maybe he's thinking, maybe there's a kernel, at least a temptation for him to think, well, maybe they were right. But Jesus says, don't be afraid. Just believe. She will be healed. And so Jesus comes to the house. They make it to the house. And when he comes in, everyone is crying and mourning for her. And as we mentioned last week, likely what's going on here is crying and mourning. There's probably a hired crowd that they've brought to this funeral. They've already accepted the fact that she was gone. And Jesus, like last week, says this. He says, stop crying, because she is not dead, but asleep. And again, like last week, it translates sort of harsh. But he says, don't cry. I see this as less of a command of, you better stop crying or else I'm not going to do what I'm going to do. And more of Jesus wiping their tears from their eyes and saying, this is going to be okay. He says, she's not dead, but asleep. And the crowd sort of doesn't really know what to do with this. And again, all the crowd probably isn't close, intimate family. But it says they laughed at him, knowing she was dead. As we saw last week, Jesus said in Luke 6 that blessed are those who weep, for their mourning will be turned into laughter. And that's exactly what Jesus does here, except for it happens in a little bit more ironic way, where they're laughing in a semi-mocking way. But Jesus is about to turn those laughs of mock into a laugh of joy. And it says, he took her by the hand, and he says, my child, get up. And to everyone's surprise, they can't believe he's saying this. What is he talking about? And to their surprise, her spirit returned, and at once she stood up. And then Jesus told her to give something to eat. And then because his time had not yet come, her parents were astonished, but he ordered them not to tell anyone what had happened, because he had many things to do. And as we walk away from this story this morning, last week we saw a story where we talked about the God who visits. And this week, we witness a God who sees. We see Jesus, who represents God to the world and was God in the world. He sees this synagogue leader, this highly respected person in Jewish society who would lead in the synagogue and keep operations going. He would create the order of worship. He'd get the people there to help make the service happen. He was respected. He was seen as a leader. And God, through Jesus, had eyes to see him. But God also had eyes to see the person, the woman in the room that nobody else could see. He had the eyes to see the person who had been set outside of the synagogue. And this was a woman, as Warren Wiersbe says, she was defiled, destitute, discouraged, desperate. But she came to Jesus and her need was met. Because we serve a God who sees both the synagogue leader and the person left out of the synagogue because of their state. Jesus saw the ruler of the synagogue and the unclean left out of the synagogue. That's the God we serve. And he's able to see each one in this room. But he's able to see all of his creation outside of this room. People who look different than us. People who act different than us. And that's what we learn about Jesus in this story. And we learn about God in this story. Not only that he's able to see each person for who they are. That they're created in his image. And that they're worthy of love. But we also see that God willingly works in their life. No matter what their situation is. God is working in their life to draw them to him. And so what we learn is that God's power is not constrained by our expectations. Right? Our expectations is that God would do good to the synagogue leader, the man who has devoted his life to serving in the synagogue. But we wouldn't think that God would be working in the life of the person who's in the state of uncleanliness, the person who's been marginalized. We always think that God's going to work in the person who has done everything. And not to say in this case that the woman had done anything wrong, but from a society, or from expectations of our society, right? God's power is not constrained by our expectations. If we take it to a situation of those who are living a life trying and striving for to do good and to follow Jesus compared to those who live in immorality, right? Our expectation that God would just work in the one who is following Jesus, trying to do what's right. But God continues to work even in the lives of those who are immoral, which is different than this situation, but I think that's true as well. We want to see them come to Jesus, but God wants them even more. God wants and is currently working to draw people to him. And then the other thing we learned is that God's power is not limited by our timetable. God's power is not limited by our timetable. And that's what we see Jairus struggling with. He says, no, she's dead. There's nothing more that Jesus can do. And that's what his household, that's how they felt. But what's so miraculous is about this story is that Jesus not only had the power over disease and sickness, but he had the power over death and the ability to reverse the effects of death. But this story, just like last week, this resurrection story is not just about God's power, but it's about God's invitation to you and me. That you and I are invited to look at this story, to see how Jesus acted, and then to go out and go and do the same thing. So as we end today, our go and do is to have eyes to see. To be able to see the synagogue leader and be able to impact those who are higher up in our society, but also to have eyes just as equal that can see the marginalized. And to be able to step into their life and to help. And step into their life to make it better. To bring life. To bring resurrection through the power of the cross. And the power that Christ gives us. But to be able to do good in real, tangible, physical ways as well. As we continue this series, Resurrection Stories, we have two more weeks. As we lead up to Easter, which will be the last day of this series, we'll, of course, have our Easter service. We're going to have an Easter egg hunt. And although those are just small ways as we are observing the Lord's resurrection every week, and as we give special attention to that, as it matches up with the calendar of Easter as well. But we want to celebrate that. We want to make an opportunity where we can invite those in our community, invite our friends and neighbors. And so this week, I want to leave us with this announcement that in the mail, you'll receive one of these, and those who aren't here will receive one of these. And many people who are associated with Northeast will receive a little flyer to remind us of Easter coming and a little invitation to our Easter egg hunt for children ages 0 to 12 and their families following services on that Sunday, March 31st. But we also have a stack of these outside so that you can take more. You have yours coming in the mail, but if you want to take more of these and hand out to any friends and neighbors, that's a great opportunity to see people and invite people. But hopefully we step into that more than just giving an invitation. That's important. God invites us and we can invite other people. But that we step into people's life in real ways and bring life through the power of Christ and His Spirit that He gives us to show up, serve, be the hands and feet of Jesus to help all people as we strive to draw people to Him. But maybe this morning, as we think about, yes, reaching out to people and helping write their resurrection stories, maybe this morning you're thinking about your own resurrection story. And there's things in your life that aren't right, and you know it, and it needs resurrected. The truth is, none of us can resurrect anything. None of us have the power to bring life of our own being or to produce fruit in an effective way. That only comes through the power of Christ and the power that His Spirit who dwells within us gives us to produce life, to produce fruit. And maybe this morning you need a little bit of that power that comes through the blood of Christ and the power of His Spirit. And if that's you this morning, then we invite you in just a moment to come forward as we sing. Whether it's to get something off your chest or whether it's you want to confess Christ this morning and be resurrected in baptism. Or if this morning there's something you want to bring to a couple of our elders privately, you can do that in our prayer room in the Kidman wing on my right, your left. Whatever your need is, we give you the invitation to come as we stand and while we sing.